From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, expand the search. The White House confirms reports the search for a missing Malaysian airliner may spread to the Indian Ocean.
We will find that debris field that will lead us to the wreckage, and then from there we'll be able to recover the recorders, and that will tell us the tale of Malaysian 370.
Russia flexes its military might on Ukraine's border as Interim Prime Minister Yatsenyuk addresses the UN Security Council. Also today, another two people die in Venezuela with violent protests now ongoing for a month. And papal report card. We look at the first 12 months of Pope Francis.
He is a figure on the international stage as well that political leaders feel they need to talk to. President Putin has been to see him. President Obama will be seeing him very soon.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The White House is calling on Russian authorities to abandon plans to hold a referendum this Sunday about the future of the Crimean Peninsula. Secretary of State John Kerry, who is due to meet the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in London on Friday, says the U.S. will react if Russia attempts to annex Crimea after the vote. He told members of Congress that his message to Minister Lavrov will be that confrontation can be avoided.
Our choice is not to be put in the position of having to do that. Our choice is to have a respect for the sovereignty and independence and integrity of the country of Ukraine.
The U.S. is also sending a delegation of lawmakers to Ukraine ahead of the vote. They say they want to show support and solidarity with the interim administration in Kiev. The British government is also calling on Russian officials to abandon the referendum. British Foreign Secretary William Hague says the vote cannot be internationally recognized.
Imagine having a referendum called at a few days' notice with no electoral roll, in the presence of tens of thousands of foreign troops. By any standards of the democratic world, this is not a referendum.
Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry has announced large new military exercises as the armed standoff continues in Ukraine that has been internationally condemned as Russian aggression. Tom Barton reports from FSN's Moscow Bureau.
The new drills are reportedly taking place near Ukraine's eastern border. They are said to be preparing for combat missions on unfamiliar terrain. Personnel from motorized rifle, artillery and tank divisions have been redeployed closer to the frontier. In addition, Belarus's president Alexander Lukashenko is expected to ask Russia to send more warplanes there in response to increased NATO drills in eastern Europe. Ukraine is itself trying to mobilize troops to prepare to defend its territory from a feared Russian invasion as Kiev and the international community try to coordinate a response to Russian forces trying to force remaining Ukrainian garrisons in Crimea to surrender.
The Pentagon is ordering a U.S. destroyer to start searching for the missing Malaysian Airlines jet in the Straits of Malacca, west of the plane's original flight path. Reports in Washington say the U.S. now believes the plane may have come down in the Indian Ocean. Our U.S. correspondent Simon Marks reports.
The USS Kidd is being given new orders by the 7th Fleet. The destroyer is being told to concentrate its search on the Straits of Malacca amid reports that US officials believe Flight 370 strayed dramatically from its flight path and ultimately came down west in the Indian Ocean. It will take another 24 hours before the ship is in position. Another US destroyer is abandoning its search of the South China Sea in the region where the plane last made contact.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A court in London has heard claims that Princess Diana leaked information about Prince Charles to someone she thought of as an ally in the press in order to seek revenge on her estranged husband. The incident is reported to have taken place in 1992. The information emerged during the trial of eight people, including former royal editor for the News of the World tabloid newspaper, Clive Goodman, who faces various charges related to phone hacking. From London, Catherine Drew reports.
Former royal editor for the News of the World, Clive Goodman, told the court Diana sent him a telephone book with contact numbers for royal staff and members in 1992, after she separated from Prince Charles after 11 years of marriage. Mr. Goodman said Diana had been going through a difficult time and wanted him to see the scale of her husband's staff and household. He said the princess, who died in a car crash in 1997, wanted to show her estranged husband that there were forces that would take him on. Mr. Goodman said he used the royal contacts supplied to him for stories, but denied ever hacking any of the phones.
And U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder is urging the U.S. Sentencing Commission to reduce the duration of prison sentences for most nonviolent drug offenses. The new policy would reduce prison populations and save money at a time when one in four prisoners globally are in American jails. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
The new policy on sentencing guidelines, as proposed by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, maintains the harshest penalties for the worst offenders, the violent drug traffickers. But 70% of those incarcerated for drugs offenses would see their sentences reduced by an average of nearly a year. The Obama administration points out the change is a win financially, with America spending $80 billion annually on jails.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The White House has confirmed reports that the search for a missing Malaysian airliner may be expanded to the Indian Ocean. Flight 370 disappeared Saturday during a flight from Malaysia to Beijing. The US and several other nations are involved in helping Malaysian authorities find the Boeing 777 aircraft. Speaking earlier, President Obama's press secretary, Jay Carney, said the US is offering Malaysia substantial assets to help in the search. As that search continues, theories about the passenger jet's whereabouts pile up. To discuss the latest, I spoke to aviation veteran and Chief Executive Officer of Safety Operating Systems, Captain John Cox.
This is a very, very unusual case. I think the term unprecedented is appropriate. And what we have is limited evidence and a very dedicated search team that is covering tens of thousands of square miles of ocean looking for this jet. I'm very confident we will find it, but it is right now, it is a mystery, and it's unlike any accident that I have worked in the 30 years of being an investigator.
You're very confident that some part of this airline will eventually be found, but we're now into day six. We have an expanding search. The White House has announced that that search may spread as far as the Indian Ocean now, all suggestive of the fact that Malaysian Chinese authorities and everyone surrounding this story has still very little real idea of where the airline is.
Well, if you look back in history, we have never not found an airplane that's been involved in a major accident and come up with a cause and conclusion that had passengers on board. So based on that history and examples such as the Air France A330 in the South Atlantic some years ago, I'm convinced that we will find the airplane. There is a debris field out there, and it's we will find that debris field that will lead us to the wreckage. And then from there, we'll be able to recover the recorders, and that will tell us the tale of Malaysian 370.
In another twist in this tale, we heard earlier from the Wall Street Journal reporting that U.S. investigators believe that the flight may have remained in the air for up to 4 hours, and they were using data that was taken from Boeing 777 engines. Is this technology something that you're familiar with?
Engine health monitoring data is frequently uploaded by modern jet airliners, and the fact that they have some information needs to be carefully evaluated. It needs to be very careful about the timestamps to make sure that there is a continuous stream of data that makes sense of what time it was transmitted and who has it, and then the limited parameters that it provides. So it is a piece of evidence. I would not call it conclusive, but it goes into the growing stack of evidence that the investigators have to help locate this airplane.
And in terms of the search, if a plane hits water, what form of debris could they potentially be looking for? Or could every remnant of that plane have either been taken by a current out of the picture or have just simply sank?
Every accident that I am aware of in water has had floating debris. Things such as seat cushions and life vests, and there's a number of things in the airplane that, once it breaks open, tend to come out and float. So that's an indicator, a strong indicator, that we will find a debris field, and they will float for quite some period of time. So I believe that we find a debris field. At the difficulty now is going to be the length of time that has transpired is working the current data back to get us to the wreckage. And fortunately, there are people with Woods Hole and other experts in the marine business that understand currents and can help locate the wreckage once we find the debris field.
Aviation veteran Captain John Cox. This is FSN Reports. As Sunday's referendum in Crimea looms, the Ukrainian Prime Minister has travelled to the United Nations to address the Security Council.
The Ukrainian government is absolutely open. We want to have talks. We don't want to have any kind of military aggression.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk is meeting with diplomats before the vote on whether the Crimea region should break away from Ukraine. Earlier, I spoke to FSN's UN correspondent, Nick Harper, to find out what the Prime Minister's trip was about.
Well, yes, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is speaking to the UN Security Council. Really, all of this is a trip to try and gather support. He met with President Obama in the White House yesterday. That was an opportunity for the president to say that he stood by Ukraine, that America was giving Ukraine its full backing. So here it is today with the Prime Minister Yatsenyuk at the United Nations, also looking for this support. And it's something that he is already getting from the Western countries here at the United Nations. Some of the states and the countries have already called for Russia to respect Ukraine's sovereignty, to respect its territorial integrity. And we've also heard from the Ukrainian parliament. They have voted asking for the United Nations to address the situation in Crimea, some of them even calling for a UN peacekeeping force. So when Yatsenyuk speaks to the Security Council today, we will see the backing that he gets from the Western powers, but we'll also see pushback from Russia. And it'll also be a chance to see how isolated Russia has become here at the United Nations in terms of the Ukrainian crisis.
We'll watch with interest how that referendum proposed for Sunday actually unfolds and what happens there. But meanwhile, Russia is continuing to flex its military muscle with manoeuvres close to the Ukrainian border. What can you tell us about that?
Absolutely, yes, a very clear show of strength this. Russia has said that it started more military drills along the border with Ukraine. We're being told that around 8,000 troops are involved, but they've also shown off some of their artillery as well. We've seen rocket launchers, howitzers, anti-tank guns. All of this a real show of strength. Now, on the opposite side of the border, Ukrainian's parliament has voted to create a 6,000-strong National Guard. Their feeling is that they need to have this National Guard ready for the potential, if it comes to it, that they are ready to defend the country. On top of that, the US Secretary of State John Kerry, who's meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in London on Friday, has said that things could get ugly fast if the wrong choices are made. And he said it would get ugly in multiple directions, but not quite spelling out exactly what that might mean. But the big worry is that with both sides ramping up the rhetoric, getting ready with their troops, we could get to a rather dangerous situation.
And can you explain if there's any link between the crisis that's occurring in Ukraine, the diplomatic standoff between the United States, and the timing of the arrest of an influential Ukrainian billionaire in Vienna today?
That's right, yes, the Ukrainian gas tycoon, Dmytro Firtash. Now, this is someone that the FBI has been investigating since 2006. He's one of the richest men in Ukraine and was one of the influential financial backers for the ousted president, President Yanukovych. Now, Austrian police are saying that there's no link between the timing of this arrest. The FBI have investigating him for several years on bribery and corruption charges. But the fact that he has been arrested at this very politically sensitive time does make for very interesting timing.
Nick Harper at the UN headquarters in New York. Now, as the feud continues between the Senate and the CIA over a still-secret report on the torture of detainees, a new investigation finds the White House has been blocking Congress's access to thousands of important documents. This revelation contradicts President Obama's public stance that he supports the Senate investigation and wants the torture report to eventually be accessible to the public. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
Lawmakers and civil liberties advocates are demanding more transparency and accountability from the White House as it tries to navigate a scandal involving claims the Central Intelligence Agency spied on Senate staffers, who are in turn accused of taking classified documents. At a press conference this week, White House spokesperson Jay Carney reiterated that the president supports the Senate's efforts to uncover the truth about the CIA torture program.
The president's number one focus in all of this has been to ensure that the committee is able to do its investigation, to complete its investigation, and upon completion of that investigation, to submit it for declassification, for the findings to be declassified. And the president urges the committee to finish its work and to submit it for declassification. He believes that that's an important part of a process that allows the American people to be informed about what happened and also for us to bring this chapter to a close.
But an investigation by the news organization McClatchy released Thursday found that since 2009, the White House has been preventing the Senate Intelligence Committee from accessing nearly 10,000 documents related to the torture program. And though Carney said the White House will not weigh in on or make judgments about the dispute until the Inspector General and Justice Department announce their findings, some civil liberties advocates say not taking sides is the same as siding with the CIA.
The president is the boss of the CIA director. The CIA is an executive agency, so I don't know that it makes sense for the executive branch to be distancing itself from itself.
That's attorney Kathleen McClellan with the Government Accountability Project, one of dozens of organizations that wrote to the president this week demanding stricter oversight of the intelligence community and legal accountability, both for the new surveillance charges and the original interrogation program.
The only person to go to jail for anything in connection with the torture program is the whistleblower, John Kiriakou, who helped expose it.
When President Obama took office, he signed an executive order banning torture, but gave legal immunity to the officials that carried it out, many of whom have since been promoted to more powerful government positions. Constitutional lawyer Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee says the president's current neutral stance, including playing down the dispute as a matter of protocol, is unacceptable.
The president is asleep at the switch while one of the most significant controversies under his administration is boiling. I do think that he runs the risk of undermining the power of the presidency by leaving it on the sidelines at the time that a very crucial contested question is emerging with respect to the constitutional balance of power between Congress and the executive branch.
Buttar and other civil liberties advocates, as well as some members of Congress, have also called on the White House to fire CIA Director John Brennan. But the White House press secretary said the president has great confidence in him, and that's not going to happen. Kentucky Republican Rand Paul, a likely candidate in the next presidential election, said if the agency is found to have broken the law, he too will demand that Brennan step down.
There's an incredible arrogance to me that the CIA thinks they can spy on the committee that is providing oversight for the CIA. And I think it's a very serious constitutional breach. And anything in my power to investigate this and determine and who did it. And really, if they've broken the law, they should leave office.
As all sides wait for the Justice Department to release the results of its investigation, Paul said the outcome of this dispute will determine the possibility of any meaningful oversight of the executive branch's actions in the future. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Another two people have been killed in violent protests in Venezuela, unrest that began exactly 1 month ago today. Government forces have clashed with demonstrators calling for political and economic reforms. The Obama administration says it's prepared to use sanctions against the country if the crackdown against protesters continues on its bloody path. For more on the events, I spoke to Venezuela-based political analyst Miguel Velarde.
Yesterday, March 12th, we have commemorated 1 month since this protest began last February 12th. Unfortunately, like you say, violence is only escalating. We have reached officially today 28 deaths in this month of protests. We also have more than 1,300 imprisonments of students, hundreds of students injured, and also almost 40 situations of torture by the official forces here in Venezuela. The problem is that the government, it seems that the government decided only to repress and to attack the pacific protests of the students in Venezuela, and the students don't seem to be able or to be willing to stop them now. So we have today a very difficult, a very uncertain scenario here in Venezuela. But we also can predict that the protest and the violence is going to only escalate in the following days.
Can you remind us how this protest has snowballed from the student beginning to broader issues about social, political and economic freedom in Venezuela?
Well, we have to remember that Venezuela is going through a very difficult economic and social crisis since last year. Last year, 2013, Venezuela ended up the year with an inflation of over 56%, one of the highest in the world. Also, levels of shortage and violence of the highest, one of the highest of the world in the world. So that's the context of the protest. But the problem was that in February, on February 12th, when the students decided to go to the streets to protest, the reason was not the economic or the social problems. The reason were higher problems, problems like freedom, problems like freedom of speech, problems like democracy. This problem escalated so quickly in only 1 month because the first day that the students went to the streets in a number that were over 100,000 people in the streets of Caracas, that day the government, instead of letting them protest in peace, like it is protected in the Constitution here in Venezuela, they decided to attack them with a lot of violence that ended up that day with 3 deaths and, like we were saying earlier, with a lot of injured people and detainees. After that day, the students only went to the streets every day to protest and protest more. They decided not to leave the streets, and the government decided to attack them and repel them even more. So 1 month later, we have almost 30 deaths, and like we said, hundreds and hundreds of injured people, hundreds of detainees, and even torture here in Venezuela. In 1 month, we can say that not only for Venezuela, but for the entire world, everybody sees Venezuela with different eyes. I think that everybody is realizing the kind of regime that we have in Venezuela, and we don't know how this is going to end now.
Miguel, can you explain what role the US can play in this situation? Because yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry, he said that the US government, the Obama administration, is prepared to sanction Venezuela if this situation continues to descend into more violence and bloodshed. But is that the solution? What punitive measures could help this situation?
From now on, what role is going to play the U.S. in this crisis? I think that the U.S. should play the same role as the many other countries should play in the continent and around the world, that is, condemn and see all the measures possible to condemn the government of Venezuela that is attacking their own people with unbearable force and with violence that is not justified by any means.
Venezuela-based political analyst Miguel Velarde. Now, Pope Francis has been marking 1 year since he was elected to the head of the Catholic Church in Rome. In just 12 months, the popularity of the new pope has been meteoric, with intense global media interest for a pontiff who has cut a more humble figure, perhaps, than his predecessors. The Argentinian has a busy year ahead, with issues including divorce and homosexuality on the church's agenda. For more on Pope Francis's first anniversary, I spoke to James Roberts, assistant editor of The Tablet, an international Catholic newspaper.
I'd say it's certainly been eventful and successful in many ways, yes. Successful, I think, in the way he has made an impact on the wider world outside the Catholic Church. Certainly he's been recognized in many ways from that point of view. Seen the cover of Time magazine and Rolling Stone and so on. Everyone knows about that. So the non-Catholic, even non-Christian world has seen what he's doing and liked it. I think in particular the way he reaches out to the poor and refugees and doesn't keep himself apart from ordinary people. He mixes very readily with in Rome he always embraces all the disabled people who come and makes a point of that. Obviously, he doesn't make a great show of his own prestige. He manages to convey a sense of humility, I think.
He's also a pope that's been applauded for taking on the issues of sexual abuse and mismanagement by the Catholic Church. And his image doesn't seem to have been dented by that recent UN report, a devastating report by all accounts, that accused the church of covering up for thousands of child-abusing priests reported to the Vatican.
It did indeed. And I think the jury is still out on the whole abuse question because there were various cover-ups and all sorts of incidents that haven't really been, even now, been addressed properly, I think. And yes, it's acknowledged the wrongs that were done. But some people, certainly within the church, feel that he needs to go rather further on that, I have to say, in terms of making sure that, say, if there were bishops who covered up abuse, that they are brought to book, so to speak. He made the point after the UN report that the Catholic Church has gone to great lengths to sort out this dreadful problem, and the Catholic Church has. But I think there's still some way to go on that.
This is a pope who hasn't shied away from engaging in international and political issues.
We have to see yet how things are going to unravel this year in terms of relations with other faiths, for example. He's going to go to Israel, and his relations with Judaism are very strong. But also, he has had a role on the international stage. You may remember last September, when President Obama was pushing to attack Syria following the discovery of chemical weapons use there. Pope Francis held a prayer vigil to pray for peace in Syria, and of course, for various reasons, and many people would believe partly because of the prayers, the attacks never happened. Of course, Congress would have resisted, and there was resistance in the Parliament here, Westminster. The reason I mention those things is that I think he is a figure on the international stage as well that political leaders feel they need to talk to. President Putin has been to see him, President Obama will be seeing him very soon.
James Roberts with the Catholic newspaper The Tablet. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the programme by emailing reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter @featurestory. Coming up on Friday, we find out what it's like to live in South Africa's gated communities. That's Friday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a good evening. Goodbye.